Okay. I just did wrote three books in a row that were really research intensive, and spent a whole lot of time looking into religious belief and non-belief in the United States, and especially this last one, the one that Sam mentioned, In Faith and in Doubt, is the first book on marriages between religious and non-religious spouses. And there's a tremendous amount that I learned in that, including an awful lot about millennials. And what it is that you are doing differently from your elders, and why that's a good thing, especially in this kind of cultural discourse, we'll call it, between religion and non-religion. I was born in 1963, last year of the baby boom, and baby boomers were influenced in atheism. Our picture of atheism was Madeline Murray O'Hare. This was the image that I had growing up of what atheism was. Madeline was active in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, in your face, flipping off the camera, you know, just really aggressive atheism. And it was powerful, and it scared the crap out of me. When I was a teenager, growing up, discovering that I was an atheist, and I, as far as I knew, there were only two atheists in the world. There was me and Madeline. I seriously thought that, because it was actually possible before the internet to think such a thing. And it alienated me from my own beliefs. I mean, I really didn't see a way forward because I was, you know, there was a lot of difference between me and Madeline. And religion was represented by Jerry Falwell. A lot of people now think of Pat Robertson primarily. In the 70s and 80s, it was Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority. Now, those of you who think that we're in danger of theocracy now and, you know, the religious right is resurgent and taking over the government, you have no idea what it was like. In the 80s. I mean, that was really a period when there was just a terrifying grip on the culture that the religious right had. What we have today is really feeble by comparison. And that galvanized my generation in free thought. That experience of this very black and white Madeline Murray O'Hare versus Jerry Falwell kind of cultural dynamic led us to a certain kind of approach to free thought that I think was appropriate at the time, at least more appropriate, and is less and less appropriate as time goes on. A lot is changing. This is some of the stuff that I uncovered in the research for this latest book. And millennials, in the way that you are approaching both millennials in the free thought movement and religious millennials, in the way you're approaching this conversation, you are showing that you recognize the way things are changing, that there's still a tremendous amount of poison and there's still a tremendous amount of work to be done, but that there are also some nuances that people in my generation frequently fail to see. And so that's what this talk is about, kind of seeing those nuances better. So it's in two acts. The first act is the first thing that I think we need to see more clearly, which is religious people. And the second act is non-religious people. So aside from religious people and non-religious people, I think we're seeing everything just fine. But one of the things we have to do is get past this black and white idea. And one of the best illustrations, I think, of the black and white is the electoral map. When we have a presidential election and we see this red and blue map on the TV screen, this thing screws with our heads in a really bad way. I think it's a terrible psychological thing that it does to us. We look at that and we see that Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, and Iowa and all that, yay, congratulations, you're all blue. Okay, everybody in this state is a Democrat. That's great. I live in Georgia, okay? Everybody in the, I assume there's some tiny little blue dot there that represents me, but everybody else is apparently red. This map is a lie. It's a terrible, terrible lie that comes from our electoral college system, which is a terrible, terrible system. But even knowing that it's a winner-take-all system, I still can't get it out of my head that Georgia's a red state, right? That Wisconsin is a blue state. Neither one of those is true. And a Princeton mathematician named Robert Vonderby came up with this fantastic solution to this, which you've probably seen, which is called Purple America. He took every county in the United States and colored it purple in the precise ratio of red to blue that represented the actual votes in that county. And you come up with this map. Now, that's a fabulous thing to me. Among other things, you know, look at Georgia. Georgia is purple. It's actually a lot more purple than some of the western states, which are really, you know, looking pretty red regardless. And it just helps you realize that the really clear demographic lines, the really clear divisions between us are illusions, and that we have these manifestations like the red-blue map that give us a false sense of our division. Georgia went 45.5% for Barack Obama. Obama lost, and it's very typical. It wasn't just a racial divide either. Georgia typically goes 42, 44, 46% for the Democrat in a presidential election. Republicans consistently win the state, but they win it by about 5 or 6%. Now, that means that when I look around the state and sort of have the feeling that I'm surrounded by reactionaries, you know, that I, especially in election years, I'm just depressed looking around and realizing I'm the only one who's not voting Republican. It's not true. It's not true. And we know this as soon as we put the Obama sign in our front yard and we have neighbors jogging by say, hey, me too. And I had no idea, right? Because I thought everybody else was red. So we need to begin seeing purple. And you know where I'm going with this. We need to do the same thing in religion and non-religion. Religious labels create this false sense of polarization, right? I'm an atheist, somebody else is a Christian, and therefore we have essentially nothing in common, right? It's a red and a blue distinction. It implies this polar difference. But there's a great way, there are several great ways to bring out the purple in religion, and one of them is the Belief-O-Matic quiz. Has anybody taken the Belief-O-Matic, familiar with this? Oh, not too many. You've got to do this. You go to beliefnet.com, okay, and there's a button that says take the Belief-O-Matic quiz, and it gives you a quiz with 20 multiple choice questions based that relate to belief, religious belief. What's the nature of the deity is one of the questions, and it'll say there is one God, another one will say there are many gods, another one says it's an impersonal force, and another one says there's no God whatsoever. And so you choose the one that's true for you, and you indicate how important that point is for you. You go on to the next one. Get to the end of it, you click submit, and it doesn't just tell you what you are, you're a Lutheran, you know, or something like that. That would be fine. It's much more interesting. It actually spits out 20 worldviews and your percentage of alignment with each one. So I actually take this every year, roughly every year, and last time I took it, I came out 100% secular humanist, 92% Unitarian, but I was also pretty darn Buddhist. I was 73% Buddhist. I was 60% mainline Protestant. And, you know, none of the theology, I mean, I don't share any of the theology, but there are values questions in there that we share. And for some reason, I'm less Jewish than I used to be. I don't know what happened there, but I'm actually a little more Catholic. I used to be 16% Catholic, and now I'm 18% Catholic. I'm a little worried about that, but that's a fascinating thing. It's a really healthy thing to look at that and say, it's not atheist over there and Christian over here. There are overlaps. And this is really a fun thing if you give it to your evangelical grandma, by the way, because she's going to find out she's 70% Islamic. That's what you get when you take the quiz and give evangelical answers. So we sometimes say that we see this nuance. We know. You know, we know that it's not all fundamentalists over here and atheists on the other side. We know there are moderates, right, religious moderates. But no matter how much we say that, a lot of times we act otherwise. And we make these very blanket statements, and we have this cartoon in our heads that we have to get rid of. An example of something that happened recently was, I think it was last year, a neuroscientist at Oxford in an interview said that someday it may be the case that extreme religious fundamentalists might be actually treated for their belief like a mental illness. You know, could actually be treated in the way that a mental illness is. And in the context that she was making the point, it was a really good point. You know, she's saying essentially this is a delusion in the same way as other delusions that we treat medically and through you know, other kinds of treatment. And it could be the same thing for extreme religious fundamentalism. Well, what do you think happened to her quote as soon as it was removed from context and handed over to atheist bloggers? It immediately became religious people. All religious people are mentally ill, okay? And it's frequently said in a way that is sort of pseudo-compassionate, right? But they're not evil, they're just mentally ill. What we have to do is really have compassion for them and offer them medical treatment, you know, to get over this. That's a nice try. Then the fact is, it's not even the fact that it's not a compassionate thing to say that bothers me. It's that it's factually incorrect. And here's an illustration of why that is. Here is a religious person of my acquaintance. This picture was taken in 2004. This religious person happens to be my wife, Becca. And at this point, 2004, we'd been married for 13 years, and she was not only religious, but a Baptist. And not only Baptist, but Southern Baptist. And she went to church every Sunday, she prayed, went through an adult baptism, during the time we were engaged. You know, this is not a sort of mildly, incidentally religious person. This is somebody who's very committed to it. Southern Baptist. Now, here's another picture of Becca. This one was taken in 2005, and she's an atheist. Because during that period of time, between 04 and 05, she'd been doing a lot of reading and a lot of talking, and we had had some discussions and all that sort of thing. I didn't push in the least because I didn't care at all, for reasons that I'll get into shortly. But she became very interested in it, and she finally decided that she didn't believe, okay? So, just to be clear, mentally ill, cured, huh? It was an amazing transition. Actually, it wasn't an amazing transition, because the point that I want to make is that almost nothing else changed about her in that transition. Now, a lot of times when people describe their deconversion, it's very dramatic, and they talk about the scales falling from their eyes, and all of a sudden everything changed, and a lot of their values changed. That's the way it happens for some people. But for most people, that's not the way it happens. For most, it's a much less dramatic change, and that was definitely the case for Becca. Now, to show you what I mean, I want to look at the Baptist faith and message. This is the statement of faith of the Southern Baptist Convention. This is, you can find it online. It's a long statement of beliefs of the convention. And a while ago, I gave that to her, and I said, I'm just curious, can you indicate the ones that you believed, you know, that you believed were true when you were a believer, and which ones you didn't? And she said, sure, and she went down and did true-false on the thing. She believed that there is a perfect, all-powerful, all-knowing God, that man is made in his image, that Christ, the gendered language, of course, is in the Baptist thing, that Christ was his son, and that baptism is, quote, an act of obedience symbolizing the believer's faith in a crucified, buried, and risen Savior, the believer's death to sin, the burial of the old life, and the resurrection to walk in the newness of life in Christ Jesus. Yes. Okay, so she believed that, all those things. Basically, God is real, Jesus is his son and our Savior, and the baptism is the new life, right? She also believed several nice things that are in the BFNM. That Christians should oppose racism, that's in there. Every form of greed, selfishness, and vice, and work to provide for the orphaned, the needy, the abused, the aged, the helpless, and the sick, and do all in their power to put an end to war. That's in there, right? That's nice. She believed those things. And that's where it stops, right? Oh, no, that's not true. There was one other thing. One of the things that's in the Baptist founding documents is a strong support for the separation of church and state. This is total news to a lot of people, including a lot of Baptists, right? But it's in there. And Jimmy Carter came out, if you remember, he came out with a book a couple of years ago called Our Endangered Values, I think it was. And he said, hey, I'm a Baptist, and one of the things that I think is really important is separation of church and state. And Baptists just pounced on him. It's written down. You know, it's not hard to see. But that's where her assent to the Baptist faith and message stopped. She never believed in original sin. She never believed in the virgin birth or biblical inerrancy or that only Christians are saved. Never. She didn't believe that she was required by the Great Commission to evangelize others. She never believed that homosexuality was immoral, nor that marriage should be the uniting of one man and one woman, nor that it was her duty to submit herself graciously to the servant leadership of her husband. She accepted evolution. She accepted the real age of the universe. She was pro-choice. And she was Baptist. Now, what she was a member of what's called the evangelical left. This is a category that most people don't even know exists because the evangelical right is so loud. But it exists, and it's large, and it's passionate. And she wasn't engaged in that as a movement, but her beliefs, the things she believed and didn't, essentially line her up with that category. And when she crossed the line from believer to non-believer, she stopped believing in God, no longer believed that Jesus was her Savior, and almost nothing else changed. All of her political beliefs, all of her values stayed the same. But the unfortunate thing is, a lot of us would have seen her as the enemy when she was religious, and an ally when she was not. The fact is, she was an ally the whole time in some of the issues that are most important to us. And yet we frequently push the moderates away, push the progressives away toward the fundamentalists and keep ourselves in our tiny little circle. We have this massive potential number of allies out there, people like my wife, that we're frequently walking away from. And again, millennials are seeing it. And that's the reason we see this real change in tone and this real change in discourse. Not millennials giving Pat Robertson a hug. That's not what's happening. They still recognize the poison. They still recognize that this influence has to be defeated, right? But they're starting to recognize there are a huge number of religious people who feel exactly the way they do on these issues. This is in the Faith Matters survey, this group of people that switches from one to the other. They called liminals, which comes from the Latin word for threshold. And the researchers said most beliefs and practices, when somebody switches from being religious to non-religious, or vice versa, are unchanged. For most people, the only thing that changes is how they describe their religious identity. Everything else stays the same. Okay. Great surveys that underline one of these important points. When we look at churchgoers, we think, what are people doing when they go to church? Why does somebody go to church? They go because they're afraid, right? They're afraid of death. They're afraid of hell. They want to bend the knee to God. They want to worship God. They want to atone for their guilty feelings and all that sort of thing. Turns out not so much. Yes, there are definitely people who go for that reason. But there have been some recent studies that really start to dig into why people go to church. Why are they there? There was a Gallup study in 2007 that asked people to name just one reason, the main reason that they go to church, that they like going to church. Very interesting question, because they don't usually ask for just one. And it's very interesting. Only 27% of the respondents to the survey mentioned God in any way, mentioned God or worship. Everybody else in the survey mentioned community and personal growth and inspiration and reflection and all these other things that can happen entirely outside of the context of God and worship. Even more important study, my favorite current study, was actually done by somebody, anybody in the sociology department here? Do you know Chiyun Lim in sociology? He's on the faculty in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he worked with a Harvard team did a study about 4 years ago now that looked at life satisfaction and church going. Now, everybody knows, right? Churchgoers are happier people. They love their lives, and we don't. But they actually dug into it in a much more interesting way. They wanted to see what the covariables were. What are the other things going on in that situation? And they found out that if you go to church and you got friends in the congregation, Your life satisfaction is at the top of the scale. Churchgoers who have a good number of friends in the congregation, happy, right? Next on the scale is us. Non-churchgoers don't go at all, are slightly below them in life satisfaction. Still doing all right. It's a slight smile. Lowest on the scale were people who go to church but have no friends in the congregation. Now, isn't that fascinating? So what the researchers said was the life satisfaction of churchgoers is almost entirely about the social aspect of religion rather than the theological aspect. People are more satisfied with their lives when they go to church because they build a social network in the congregation. Well, that changes everything. People are there for reasons other than the ones we typically think. Most people are actually there for human connection. That's a really important thing to know. So imagine, I mean, it makes sense. If everybody's going to church, and those of you who have gone to church, you know what I'm talking about. You go and you see somebody and there's lots of hugging and how are you doing, and it's a really great connection for a lot of people. Imagine if you're in that situation, being confronted with it every Sunday, everybody else is connecting and you're not. You can see why it would be at the bottom. Well, that's a very enlightening way to look at the experience. Okay, so why did Becca go to church? Why did my wife go to church? Why was that so important to her? Well, just the same. It had nothing to do with God. In her case, it wasn't even just a social thing. It was a family thing. She had a problematic... I didn't use the word I wrote down. Stepfather, who was a Baptist minister for many years, and when he left his first wife for his second, his church reacted very angrily, and he quit not only that church but all churches, and then said his family could not go to church. They could only go to church on, I think it was Mother's Day and Christmas or something like that, he gave this. But he would not permit his very religious wife and her daughters to go to church. And then my eventually to be wife, who was, you know, ninth grade or something like that at that point, said, when I'm married, like hell anybody's going to keep me from going to church. As much as anything, going to church was an act of redemption for her mother. You know, it was a family thing. It was her sort of being able to do what her mom was denied. And so we went to church together for several years, you know, when we were first married, because I knew the reason. You know, I knew that this was important to her. And that made a big difference. If I knew that she was going to church because she thought she was going to burn in hell if she didn't, it'd be hard to support that kind of thing. Her situation was unique, but it's also not unique. It's also one of the many, many reasons that people do this other than the bended knee. Okay. There's also been a change going on in religion over the course of the last few generations, a really powerful change, but it's been under the surface so much that we don't even know that the cartoons that we hold in our heads have been challenged. And one of the greatest illustrations I've seen of this is something called the Middletown Study. There is a city in Indiana called Muncie, Indiana, which at some point sociologists realized was the most average city in the United States. It's presumably on the signs as you enter the town. But just demographically and in attitudes and in, you know, the job numbers and everything, Muncie was, for most of the 20th century, America. You know, that was right down the middle. And they did a very interesting thing. Starting in the 1920s, they started surveying all the high school seniors in Muncie, Indiana, asking them a bunch of questions. And they would ask these questions every year to the senior class, and frequently they were exactly the same questions worded in the same way. And one of the questions that they asked for 90 years in a row is, well, it's a statement. Christianity is the one true religion, and all people should be converted to it. Do you agree or disagree, okay, with that statement? When they asked that question in 1924, 94% of the high school seniors agreed that it's the one true religion and all people should be converted to it, okay? By 1977, that number had dropped to 38%. But, even more interesting, Muncie was more religious by every measure than it had been in the 20s. In the 70s, it was more religious in terms of church attendance, in terms of stated belief, every act of religious engagement. This isn't because people are becoming less religious. It's because it's changing the definition of what it means to be religious. That's the important point in this this part of the talk. Another example of this is the ultimate compliment. If a religious person, one of the most toxic things a religious person can say to you is, you're going to hell because you don't share my beliefs, right? One true faith is one of the most toxic ideas in religion. So how many people say now, a good person who is not of my faith can go to heaven? Even somebody who doesn't believe the same that I do. 83% of current Catholics say yes, somebody who's not a Catholic can go to heaven. You know who disagrees with that? The Catholic Church. It's in the Catechism. It's extremely clear. There's a doctrine with its name. And what, extra ecclesiam, I can't remember the whole name of it, but it's a big deal, right? Outside of the church, there is no salvation, is the way it translates, period. And 83% of American Catholics say, eh, not so much, you know? That's a good thing to know. It makes me look at Catholics differently. If I only look at them through the catechism, I'm not seeing them, right? And I'm not seeing what we have in common. 79% of mainline Protestants agree. 62% of black Protestants. 54% of evangelicals. Look at that. More than half of Protestant evangelicals think that you don't have to be born again to be saved. Is that a surprise to you? I mean, I would think that that would be a surprising thing, because we're so used to hearing the loud conservative evangelicals that we don't even know that these other people are there. Okay, but here's the ultimate test. Who are they talking about? Who's saved? Are they just saying, okay, Presbyterians too? You know, it's us and the Presbyterians. Here's the test. Can atheists go to heaven? This is the question that was asked by the Religious Landscape Survey. 46% of mainline Protestants say, yeah, atheists can go to heaven. 49% of Catholics. Nearly half of all Catholics say that atheists can go to heaven. 26% of evangelicals. No surprise that that drops quite a bit, but still, one in four evangelicals think that we're in, okay? And 100% of current popes. Now, of course, the funny thing is, I hear a lot of people say, like I care. Why should I care if I get into your imaginary playground, right? Completely missing the point. This is the ultimate compliment that somebody can give in their belief system. So suppose you're traveling in the mountains of Peru, and you meet this tribal people, and they ask you to join them for a meal, and you learn that they have a belief that all truly good people exude a blue aura that only the elders of the tribe can see, okay? And in the middle of the meal, they turn to you and say, well, you clearly are a good person because you have the blue aura. How are you going to react? I don't believe that. No, right? You're going to be honored that they have expressed this belief in your goodness in the terms of their own system, right? You accept it. We have to do the same thing. I really get irritated when I hear atheists react ungenerously to the idea that a religious person thinks you might go to heaven. The thing to say is, thanks, that's nice. You know, it was really, really, really nasty thing to say that I was going to hell, and it's nice that you change your mind on that. Okay, so a little more on Catholics versus Catholicism. One of the reasons Catholicism is really fun to look at is that it has an owner's manual, right? The catechism of the Catholic Church is what you're supposed to believe, right? So the catechism says birth control is intrinsically evil. By the way, the catechism is not a medieval document. I mean, it is. But it was, the current catechism was written in 1992. The year Miley Cyrus was born, for crying out loud. I mean, this is not an old thing. Birth control is intrinsically evil. But U.S. Catholics who say that birth control is morally acceptable, 82%, okay? Catechism says, homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered, matters of grave depravity, under no circumstances can they be approved. And gay marriage support among U.S. Catholics is at 59%, higher than the national average. Catholics have actually been ahead of the national average in support for gay marriage for something like, you know, 15 years or whatever, even though their church specifically opposes it. Abortion is without exception a moral evil that is gravely contrary to the moral law. U.S. Catholics who say abortion should be legal, 58%. Again, it's a shock to people who think that Catholic beliefs and the beliefs of Catholics are the same thing. Let's widen out the scope here and look at some other denominations. Humans and other living things have evolved over time. Who thinks that's true? Unaffiliated, 85%. Two-thirds of mainline Protestants, two-thirds of Catholics, and a third of evangelicals think that evolution is a thing. Support marriage equality. Now, this is an interesting one because you can see the change. I just wrote this book, and I was actually trying to quote the stats on support for marriage equality, and I had to keep going in and changing the manuscript at each stage. I turned the manuscript in January, and I've gone back in twice since January and changed the number of states that have approved it and the percentile of approval. It's stunning. It is stunning how rapid this has been. And we need to recognize that we didn't do this ourselves. Now, this isn't something that the unaffiliated went in and made happen. A lot of religious people were behind the change as well. White mainline Protestant, 38% in 2001, 62% today. Black Protestant just took a big leap in the last 4 months to 43%. Catholics are at 59. White evangelicals are still very low, and it's not moving much. It's been 23% for about 6 years. So then you've got a clearer picture. Okay, we need to change the minds in the evangelical community. We can see that that's where the issue is, and we've got all these allies in that fight. That's a key thing to see. Support comprehensive sex ed. Mainline Protestant, 85%. Catholic, 78%. Do you remember? Birth control is intrinsically evil. And they're 78% support. Black Protestant, 74%. Evangelicals, this is a shock. 62% of evangelicals support comprehensive sex education. The rest of them are so loud that you would never know it. But it's a fact. Legal abortion services. Catholic, 58%. Protestant, 72%. These are important things to know. Protestants are beating us. Okay? Actually, unaffiliated is a problematic category. I hope you know that it's a mix of beliefs. Okay. So that's part one. Looking at religious people in a different way, recognizing that religious believers are a much broader spectrum, that we can build alliances with people, that they typically are not, not only are they not Noah's Arkers, but they're not going to church because they think they'll go to hell otherwise. They're going for community and connection. There are all sorts of ways in which this kind of thing can change the way we see religious people. Now it's time to change the way we look at ourselves. That's Act Two. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Now, there is essentially no difference that I can perceive in the worldview of Neil deGrasse Tyson and the worldview I have. And yet, if you ask him about atheism, he will tell you that he wants nothing to do with it. And he gets irritated when he even talks about it. And we say, oh, come on. Come on and play. He's a smart guy. And you got to wonder, why is it that somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson is not interested in owning the atheist label? Well, here's why, and here's the story he'll tell, an example. In 2009, he was at a launch of the space shuttle Atlantis. Some friends of his were on the launch, some physicists were going along, and he put this on Facebook. He wrote, "Beautiful launch, beautiful day, Godspeed Atlantis astronauts." Okay? And what did he immediately get in comments over and over and over again on his page? Atheists saying, what's with the God language? You're supposed to be an atheist. And then the entire thread got hijacked by atheists debating what Neil deGrasse Tyson should be permitted to say. And it pissed them off. For one reason, Godspeed is actually a term that's been used by astronauts since John Glenn. It's a very sort of NASA thing that they always say as the thing is departing, as the shuttle is going up or whatever it is. But even more than that, the idea of policing the language, of saying that there's this narrow little path that you have to take in order to be an atheist, is offensive, it's irritating, and it's alienating people who should be able to join up with us. People like Neil deGrasse Tyson. We should see this as an emergency, you know, when we lose somebody like that. For a pretty good reason, I think. Okay. So, one of the problems with the free thought movement as it currently stands is that we continually build a movement that we build a movement for those who are already in it, is the clearest way I can put this. Okay? We build a movement for those who are already in it. But free thought actually has a much wider spectrum in the population than those who are in it. And it's been hard to get a grip on that until now. There's a terrific survey, a study that came out last year. University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, I don't know how many have seen this, the non-believer typology. Chris Silver and Tom Coleman at Tennessee surveyed, it was more than a survey, it was a really exhaustive set of surveys and tests, 1,300 people, all of whom identify as non-believers. And they identified six different types, basic types of non-believer. The first type was what they called the academic. The academic is, here, I've got their descriptions here. I'm so far off my script here. Okay. Academic atheists love intellectual activities like reading, discussion, and healthy debate. They prefer to associate with others who have the same intellectual approach to life, even if their opinions are different, as long as they are well-informed. These are the people who really love to debate ideas and think and listen to talks and all that sort of thing. Academics make up 37.6% of the non-believer population in this study, a little over a third. Okay. Next category was the activist. Now, this is not an atheist activist. This is a person who is an atheist, but is active primarily in other things, human rights, the environment, poverty, and so on. Okay? The activist atheist wants to change the world. Their activism is mostly not about atheism. They're engaged in the struggle for civil rights, environmental concerns, animal rights, social justice, etc. They are likely to identify more with those causes than they do with atheism as a cause. Atheism Plus is a movement that is really oriented toward the activist. 23% of people fell into this category. And again, obviously there's overlap in these. Nobody's all one or the other, but it sorts out. The third was the seeker agnostic. Seeker agnostics see open-mindedness as a virtue. They recognize the limits of human knowledge and experience, and they embrace uncertainty. They don't hold a firm ideological position. Instead, they tend to search for what the researchers call the scientifically wondrous and for profound confirmation of life's meaning. 7.6% of the population, of the non-believer population fell in there. Okay. Number four, the anti-theist. Now, when most people think of non-believers, this is what they think of. They think of the anti-theist. The anti-theist doesn't just disbelieve religious claims, but is actively, diametrically, and categorically opposed to them and to the influence they have on the world. In the words of the researchers, the anti-theist proactively and aggressively asserts his or her view, challenging religious ideology as dangerous ignorance that harms human dignity and well-being, and tends to see individuals associated with religion as backward and socially detrimental, right? Religion poisons everything. And a lot of the most prominent voices in the movement are anti-theists, right? 14.8% of survey respondents fell into this category. Next was the non-theist. They use this term, but it's also been called the apatheist, which is a term I just love. It's somebody who doesn't believe, but also just really doesn't care. They've made their declaration, and they don't want to engage it. They're not interested in religion. They're not interested in non-religion. On they go. Okay, and then that was the smallest group, 4.4%. And then the last one was the ritual atheist agnostic. Alain de Botton, the atheist philosopher, has articulated this really well. I never wavered in my certainty that God did not exist, but I still like the buildings, the prayers, the rituals, the feasts, the music, and so on. Okay. So the problem is, if you compare the general population of non-believers, this is what the survey shows, right? a lot of academics, a relatively moderate amount of anti-theists, then the activists, seekers, non-theists, ritual, and so on. That's what you get from the survey, but the movement looks more like this. These tiny, tiny little slices of the seeker-agnostic and ritual-agnostic and so on, and you know, about half of the people who are in the movement are probably well-described as anti-theists. That actually makes perfect sense, right? If religion pissed the crap out of you, you left it and joined this thing that is opposed to it, right? That makes perfect sense. But a lot of the other people who don't believe, but they still kind of are drawn to some of the aspects of religion, they don't find a place in our movement. They don't find a place in our movement because we're continuing to build it for the people who are already in it. The sort of science-minded, a lot of us are science-minded kind of relative loners. We're not looking for the social connection so much. And that's why it was so easy to walk away from the church, right? This is the reason that we start to get things like, I did a presentation to a group of leaders in the Freethought community several years ago, and it talked about community and, you know, and the fact that there are a lot of experiments going on, like you know, Sunday Assembly most recently, and then a lot of other humanist community experiments. And this one leader said, "What is this obsession with community? Why is everybody talking about community?" He really didn't get it. And another one said, "Community, what you're calling community is this oppressive thing that we ran away from. I don't want to get together with people. I don't want to get into a room and be a community." There is this real, not just disinterest, but frequently a pushing away, an antipathy to the idea of community. There was an article written about a year and a half ago or something like that called "Why Seculars Don't Sing." And the thrust of it was group singing. You know, when you get together and you sing, you're all sort of giving assent to a common idea. We're all saying, "I'm putting aside my specific differences and I'm assenting to the text," whatever it is. And that's something secularists don't do. He didn't say why I don't sing or why you shouldn't sing. That, even that would have been okay. Instead, he was saying, secularists don't do this. We as a group don't do this. We have got to stop saying that. We've got to stop looking at something like Sunday Assembly, right, and saying we don't do that, okay? We do, because there it is, right? For the people who are interested in it, there it is, and there it needs to be. We need to build those options for people and increase the openness of the movement and stop defining it in terms of only ourselves. Okay, so how can millennials lead this? How can we lead this sort of change of perspective and take us in the right direction? First of all, start seeing religious people separate from the doctrines of their churches, right? Because most of them don't believe the doctrines of their churches. The churches don't change frequently, right? They usually don't change than the people do. People have been changing for generations, but we keep looking at the Catholic Church catechism and thinking that we're seeing Catholics, and we're not. One of the things I'd like to see in that area is I'd love to see freethought organizations devote part of their energy to supporting non-toxic religious expressions, right? So it's really great work that FFRF does and American Atheists and so on when they file a lawsuit because there's been an incursion into the politics or the public square or whatever by religion. That's important work. But how much more credibility would it have if, let's say, every 10th case was an amicus brief that they filed saying, yeah, that is an appropriate expression of religion and we support it. You know, some court case that's working its way through the system. That'd be a really powerful thing. I'm director of Foundation Beyond Belief. We have humanist members who contribute to 5 selected charities each quarter. And one of the charities that we choose each quarter is a progressive, non-proselytizing religious charity. Somebody that is working for the common good, they're not pushing their religion, and they are following common values with us. Right now we're supporting the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, which is a committee that has, first of all, been completely shunned by the Southern Baptist Conference, which is a good sign. They used to support them financially, and they cut off the support entirely because they're furious. They say, "You're in bed with the liberals." Yes, they are. and they're really hot. These are people who have the same value we have. They want to be able to pursue their own beliefs, independent of government interference. They want other people to be able to do the same thing. They have stood up for secular groups on college campuses that have been challenged inappropriately by the administrations. It's a really great group. And it lends us a tremendous amount of credibility when we can say, yeah, we can actually tell the difference between Fred Phelps and Jimmy Carter. You know, we can actually see the spectrum and act on it. Another thing we have to do in general is look at the religious impulse, look at what people are doing, and try to understand what is really going on. What is really happening when people pray? What is really happening when somebody says, bless you, or when they go to church? We need to really start looking at it and not just take the first answer that pops into our heads, and so that we can build other secular options that meet a lot of those same needs. Again, that's what Sunday Assembly is doing. Thank you. And several other similar things. The church is a free thought, and so on. And we also need to open up our own movement to other people who share our basic worldview, who share a naturalistic view, but don't do it exactly the same way we do. That's an absolutely crucial thing to do. Stop using ridiculous ideas like accommodationist, calling somebody an accommodationist because they actually want to work with a religious group or they say something nice about a religious person and they say, oh, you're an accommodationist. Yeah, I'm accommodating other people. I actually think that other people should be accommodated when they're doing positive things. That's fine. What this really boils down to in the end, I realized, is re-examining what constitutes a big question. I've always called God and Jesus and, you know, what happens after we die and ultimate meaning and all this, I've always referred to them collectively as the big questions, right? They're actually the small questions. I've actually realized after all these years that they're the small questions. When my wife switched from being religious to non-religious, she dropped the small questions, the things that didn't bother me that much anyway. She believed in gay rights and evolution and all these various things, and she thought God created things, okay? And then she dropped the God part. That was much, much less of a problem, the God part, than if she had agreed with me that God didn't exist, but she was anti-gay, right? Didn't support evolution, that she believed that she was supposed to be subservient to me. There are all sorts of things that would have been a much bigger problem. Those are big questions. Those are really big questions. So I think we need to flip the whole thing and realize that the God thing, yeah, okay, that's fine. Do your belief in God thing. But if you're with me on these social issues, that's the stuff that really matters. We build that coalition and we can change the culture. Thanks very much for your attention.